Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Ornovitz.
And I'm Tom Haverstrow.
Tom, we are joined by our favorite guest. No disrespect to the fantastic chefs who join us from time to time. Hershey Ash is a restaurant consultant. He is proprietor of Small Victories in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hershey, welcome.
Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here.
The occasion for Hershey's appearance, as it always is Restaurant Wars.
Woo!
Hershey, I met Hershey at one of his restaurants in, or a restaurant he was consulting in Pasadena. That was our initial cause for meeting, along with his San Antonio Spurs fandom. And he is an expert in all things. Tom, he is like the X's and O's. He is the I don't know, Tim Gergrich or of restaurants. Like, he is the luminary coach.
Yes, I can't wait to talk to him about this episode, because it's a little bit of a curveball, to cross sport metaphor here. We didn't get the conventional, hey, you need to come up with the entire restaurant concept with the decor and the menu, all that stuff. But we get more of the actual like meat and bones of what running a restaurant is. So I don't think we lose much by not having like, oh, what color scheme are we using for the restaurant? Or what's the, you know, what color are we using for the napkins here? No, we just get some full-throated back and forth drama, lots of different, I guess, strategy questions on this one. But right. But Kevin, what? The quickfire was my favorite quickfire. I love this quickfire.
Quickfire was great. The tag team. Hershey, what did you think of the quickfire?
I like the quickfire. I like the tag team. I was kind of a little bit concerned about someone being under a blindfold for like 30 minutes and then coming out into the light. That feels like, I believe that there was a term for it under the Bush administration for that kind of behavior. But Yeah, I mean, I thought that that was – I actually think – has that happened again? That's actually a brilliant idea. Maybe they could do it without the blindfold, but I love that idea of, like, tag team cooking. I actually think that's brilliant. I would like to be involved in a challenge like that, I think.
Yeah, we had the producers on the show at the end of this last season, the live season that just ended, and I was like, you know what you need to bring back is the blindfold tag team question, where it's like a game of telephone and you can't tell the person before you what you're cooking. And the producer's like, well, if you're doing a rewatch of season six, you're in luck, because they do it in that season. And yes, you're right, we should do it more often. I just love it. It requires so much, you need so much self-awareness. You need so much you have to understand your teammates. I don't know, if you had the first pick of where you wanted to do, like, the first, the second, the third, or the fourth slot, man, if I'm the alpha, if I'm Michael Voltaggio, or if I'm, who was the other, it was Jen who got to pick the first pick. I don't know whether I'd want to start or finish. What do you guys think?
I got to tell you, I think Jen won the challenge by having to go first. So she gets to choose the ingredients and then having the foresight to start a broth/stock, right? Like something that required time, that would, by virtue of the fact that it required time, would add a real richness to the dish and kind of a weight. And she kind of won that challenge. And I think it was the perfect role for her. I mean, obviously, you go forth, you got to kind of finish execution, you got to plate the thing. To the extent that there are fuck-ups, you've got to correct them.
Yeah.
Ultimately, like anything that's wrong at that point, there's no one left to do that. But to me, Jen won that challenge with that stock and broth, getting the table set, something that the other team didn't really do sufficiently.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, per your point, even just tactically, not just from a flavor point of view, but the stock can only go one place, right? So the second person would have opened their eyes and gone, okay, this is the stock, this is what's in it. Okay, I have to start cooking towards the sauce, yeah, into the flavor amplification rather than the other way around. I also think I guess we'll come to it in a second, but it's ironic how well and amazingly they work together without any conversation. And then when you gave them a day to organize themselves, it all kind of went to shit, as it were. So yeah, that was a great dichotomy.
Yeah. But they didn't even use the stock, right? Kevin.
Oh, no. They did. They did. That seared sablefish, which she thought was trout, was sitting on the sauteed mushrooms in that ginger shiitake broth, which I think really gave it, you know, sort of not only a sophistication, but really a balance and everything else. I also thought it was interesting, Tom Hershey, the weak links went second. And Voltaggio kind of explained it, I think, very well, which is, to the extent that they're going to fuck up, or for that matter, they just don't bring much, third and fourth can rectify that. But they're also not first, which is really the table setter. Am I correct? And I never ran track relay, obviously. I'm just the slowest motherfucker around. But, like, doesn't the second leg tend to be, like, not the weak link, but the slowest or the least? Isn't that generally how it works?
Yeah, I think it's actually the third. But, I didn't run track, but, I mean, Kevin and I are both serious swimmers, almost Olympic level, I would imagine. Certainly Kevin during this quarantine. But like in swimming, yeah, you usually have here, sound very Australian talk about swimming, but in swimming, yeah, you normally have the slowest swimmer goes third.
But I also think that because Michael Voltaggio, so here's how the draft went. Jen went first, then she picked Kevin, then right. Michael Voltaggio picked his brother Brian, and then Jen picked Mike Isabella. Then Mike Voltaggio picked Eli. Then Jen goes Loreen. And Robin is the last pick. Now, Hershey, you have not watched this season, correct?
I watched a couple episodes before to lead in.
Oh, okay. So you knew kind of how good Michael Voltaggio has been, and Jen is pretty strong. And the draft, Kevin, the interesting thing about the draft to me was Michael Voltaggio drafted his brother. And I think he either had to go 3-4 with his brother or 1-2. And he decided he didn't want Eli and Robin to finish the dish. But I kind of thought because Michael Voltaggio is such a control freak and he's someone who just has a vision and he's going to execute, I almost thought that he might be better off going first.
Nah, he's gonna be. He wants to plate. He wants to finish the execution. Yeah. Like anybody can take shit out of a cupboard or a fridge.
And, I don't know.
I disagree. Now,
he only has the ingredients that he can work with. I guess maybe Brian Voltaggio is going to be able to steer whatever he got into what he knows that Mike, his brother, will like.
And by the way, I think Jen is sort of perfectly suited for that role. Not that she couldn't have executed the end. She's got vision, and I think that was going to be key. And Kevin is sort of perfectly suited to four.
Yeah. And I think it's smart to do the second as your least strong teammate.
Right. Cause you can neither screw up the conception nor can you screw up the execution.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So
and there's also provided to it, right? Which is his thinking would have been, and this is all chefs, is I don't care what you give me. I can make a good dish.
They didn't win though. So Michael Voltaggio doesn't win. They do like a steak. And Jen, she wanted to poach the fish in that oil. Right. And Kev's like, you know what? I'm not going to do that. And you could see Jen off to the side, like pulling out her hair because she's stressed out. I was wondering, guys, do you think you would have done like a communication system? Like if they started doing something
like signs in baseball or something,
I don't know if it's signs, but like if someone was doing, executing the dish in a way you didn't like, you just like cough? Cause you could see off to the side that Jen was like, no, I don't. And then like when it was over, she was like, yeah, good job. But I could really feel that whatever Kevin was doing was, she was just kind of like, no, wait, I wanted
to. You know what's funny about that? And I was thinking about this, Tom. She thought it was trout. Had she known it was sablefish, which is a wonderfully fatty fish, which means I think that it can stand up to the grill without getting dried. I wonder if she had been less consternation about it.
I'm not sure. Cause I think what Tom's saying about the oil is right. I think she had in her mind the slow poaching in the oil. So retain this richness. And then she wanted the stock. I mean, it's funny because now I think about it now, I guess the way she thought the stock would work out, which was the part that was highlighted as the reason why she won. I get the feeling she wanted to poach it in oil, like you said, and then have the stock add brightness. And it's interesting that the stock ended up being used to add richness, to go the other way. Yeah, I'm not really sure. It wasn't clear to me, did she completely misunderstand where the fish was, or she just said it at the time that she was asked?
She said, I called black cod trout on national TV. Awesome.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. So I think she actually thought that and was clearly embarrassed, which she doesn't need to be. And as I told you, Tom, I finally perfected the Nobu miso black cod in this house. I finally got it. I didn't realize I was trying a lot of different combinations. I pan sear it and then I put it under the broiler.
And that's it.
And when I do that and I just watch it like a hawk, get that nice, you know, you can't burn it, but you just that, but you want that caramelized. I'm very proud of this. This is one of the best things to come out of quarantine. Hershey, I've nailed it.
Well, can you compare it to, because I'll give you a little tip for a place that actually does that cod so well and doesn't get any of the credit. On Third, down just below Farmer's Market, is Rabada. And they do a black cod on the coffin sort of charcoal there that is outrageous.
My problem is Rabada Junior, right?
That's the one.
You know, the problem is I don't have really a charcoal grill. I'm working with gas. I know. And by the way, I've stopped grilling a lot. I mean, so the other thing that came out of this, gentleman, coming in the mail, in transit as we speak, is my first ISI container.
There it is.
I'm ready. I'm ready to whip foams. I'm ready to get that miso butter whipped. And you know, like forget the dessert. I'm going to use it for savory. It's a big move for me. It's a little intimidating. Those cartridges, like I'm gonna blow up the house.
Can I say those cartridges fight back? Do be careful.
Oh, what do you mean they fight back?
You'll see when you try and put it in the first time.
Am I gonna hurt myself?
No, but it'll fight back a little bit. Like they don't go in as easy and quick as you know as possible. You'll see.
As like the YouTube videos suggest, like it's the easiest thing.
Yeah, you'll get on top of it, but the first time you'll be like, oh, that fought back. Yeah.
There's
pressurized gas in there, you know, like so.
Am I making a mistake?
No, I don't think so.
I mean I'm really incompetent.
Are the windows double glazed in your house?
There's a Milgard glass door, which if it gets destroyed, I'm kind of really screwed.
No, you should be okay. I mean, your hand will be there. You'll just feel a little bit of a fight back. You'll see.
So is meat like a miso butter? Is that a good place to start?
I think anything with high fat's a good place to start. Yeah.
All right. So like different butters is really a great kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm really excited. Like, I'm really, really excited. Like, this is some restaurant shit, you know? Like, yeah. I'm a little out of my league, but I'm going to give it a go.
Speaking of giving it a go, after Jen's team, the blue team wins the quick fire. Padma gives him a little bit of game theory here, or a little bit of a strategy here. She says, you guys win $10,000 to split amongst yourselves, or you can essentially double it or nothing. And basically everyone gets a $10,000.
No, it's prize. Quadruple it or nothing.
Quadruple right? or nothing. Quadruple or nothing. Everyone gets $10,000 each if you win the elimination challenge. Your thoughts on their decision to let it ride?
Tom, you know as well as I do. Easy choice. Unless you think you're less than a 25% favorite. If you're even money, it's an easy choice. If you're a dog, 2-to-1 dog, it's an easy choice, right? Am I? You're better at this than I am. Is that? Am I right here?
Yeah. If I'm looking at the Voltaggio brothers, the math gets a little bit interesting here.
Oh come on, it's still Kevin and Jen, and like you know, yeah. I'm sorry, man. Like they're not. You think they're a 4-to-1 on dog?
No. I'm just saying it's not all else equal when you're looking at, on the other side and there's. You know, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin's been cooking his ass off. She's really good. I'm sorry, they're a 3.5 point, like in the context of NBA. That's a morning line I look at. That's a 3.5 point spread. That is not. That's like Raptors tomorrow night.
I didn't watch most of the season, and obviously, we know from the Voltaggio brothers have a little bit of a reputation since. But I see that as an even money bet. Like, not, you know, the odds are a stack in the favor, right? It's an even money bet paying out 4-to-1. Because, I mean, you have the benefit of saying, oh, shit, we work really well together. They don't. And I think ultimately the things that, I mean, again, we'll get to it, but the things that let them down was not so much the things where the Voltaggio brothers would sing, right, in terms of food and flavors. I think they got let down in other areas. I see it as an even money bet.
Yeah. Yeah, Jen decides, hey, let's all just parlay it into the next round. And they get to do restaurant wars. But the weird restaurant wars wrinkle here, it's a lot of roar sounds. Whoa. Restaurant wars wrinkle here is that Padma says there's no decor. There's no any of that. We're just going to go come up with a restaurant name, come up with who's doing what, front of house, sous chef, you know, executive chef, and you're going to have two separate restaurants. You're not going to design the restaurants. You actually are just going to take RM Seafood, which is, what's his name? Rick Moonen's restaurant in Las Vegas. I have never been there. Hershey, Kevin, have you been to that restaurant?
RM Seafood? I avoid Vegas.
Okay. So it's RM Seafood. There's an upstairs kitchen, a downstairs kitchen. I was a little disappointed, got to be honest, disappointed that there wasn't going to be like decor and all that other stuff. But Hershey, right off the bat, what were your thoughts about the challenge itself?
So first of all, off the bat, like as a preamble, and I don't know if you've discussed this in previous pods, but what's interesting, and it wasn't in this episode, it was in one of the lead up episodes where I think Padma said something like, you know, I think it was the one where they had to cook for the chefs. And she was saying, you know, in these financial downturn times, you know, folks are cooking at home, so to a dinner party. And I actually thought that was a really interesting analog. We have a financial downturn at the moment that's very different to that one. But I think what was interesting was we in the industry, especially those of us that consult, had a lot of conversations in 2008, 9, and 10 around, okay, these are the things that are different that we're never going to do again. And a bunch of folks did do those things again. And a bunch of those folks are in a lot of trouble now with this financial downturn, which admittedly is much, much, much worse. So I actually thought that analog's really interesting to kind of look at it as a time where folks are kind of looking at restaurants differently already then about downsizing and using different cuts and those sort of things, which are the conversations we had in 9 and 10. And so off the cuff, the first thing that jumps out at me is I forgot how into one word name restaurants we were in 2009 and 2010. I've blocked that out of my memory. So as someone who is extremely guilty of participating in that trend, I have blocked that in my memory. But I can tell you off the top that Revolt is probably the worst restaurant name I've seen, forget about in my career, in my 40 years on this planet. And that includes several kosher restaurants in Melbourne, Australia that are terrible names. They are no longer the worst names I've ever seen in my life.
It would be like calling a kosher restaurant Trafe.
Well, there's a restaurant called Trafe in the East Village now.
Oh, that's hilarious. Hershey, I want to ask you, I'm kind of torn about this, and you're someone in our conversations, like decor and environment is important. And that's part of a substantial part of your grade as a restaurateur. So I felt, and look, this is before Restaurant Wars, Tom, became like branded as Restaurant Wars, this thing that gets over two episodes sometimes. But I do feel like I missed that component. I mean, Hershey, it's a hugely important component.
Want to ask me, I think it's actually arguably the most important component.
Which is like what it feels like, what it looks like. And
atmosphere and vibe is everything, especially for a sit-down restaurant. It's even more important than the food. I mean, there will be restaurants where both of you live that are packed every Friday and Saturday night where the food is, but it looks good and it feels good. That's why it's packed, right? So it is an extremely important thing. But, I mean, you can take it the other way. I think it took away some of the drama from the show, but it gave them an extraordinary advantage of where, okay, it's not just the food. It's not just the atmosphere. They also got staff that had worked in those venues and knew how to work and were professional waiters. So, to me, the service, that was my first thought. My first thought was, you know, we've done a few of these, and I've mentioned before, oh, my gosh, these poor, you know, people having to run a restaurant with folks who don't know what they're doing. To me, the service needed to be perfect in there because you had professional waiters who had, I don't know, let's say months, years of experience in those restaurants.
But doesn't so much of it require understanding how the kitchen and the firing and all that, the system, don't the servers require like a confidence in the management there of how the system works? And so you kind of are building from scratch there?
Yes and no, because the staff, a lot of what the staff do is automatic. So even though there would have been, okay, this is how we want to do it, there would have been staff there saying, no, but this is, we usually come in now, we usually run this, this is where stuff goes, this is where stuff gets clean, this is how we reset, automatic. And so they could have almost trained and led the atmosphere in there. Let me put it to you this way, if you're running, and that's a substantial restaurant, both of them, but if you're running even a halfway decent restaurant and it lives and dies on the manager being there and holding it together every night, something's gone very, very, very wrong.
Right.
So, you know, the basketball analog is, my team, the Spurs, the head coach is getting on a little bit, and every now and then he likes to put Becky or Timmy in charge. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Spurs don't fall apart when Tim Duncan or Becky Hammon are in charge. So, we'll come to it in a second. I think the service fell down on both places, but I think the team that lost made some terrible mistakes. But yeah, in terms of the names, the Revolt was just horrible, horrible, horrible name. And I think what would have been fun to have seen how they acted out the name Revolt if they would have had to do decor, because I think they would have taken a terrible decision and made it even worse.
No. You could have done those cool agitprop if the 20th century kind of Maoists and communists did anything.
But I was just going to say.
Those posters are cool. Like they did graphic design well.
It would have looked like a Soviet era restaurant with like voltage. Yeah,
remember that bar in New? Oh, God, y'all are too young. There was this great bar called KGB. Yeah, and it was like a place in the 90s that I went a fair amount.
Like 10 years ago, there was a spot on Melrose called Mao's Kitchen that had a lot of Chinese-era communist stuff, which I don't think it's any longer with us, unfortunately.
Two decisions off the top that I wanted to ask you about. Jen, they decided to go with Mission, the name Mission, whatever. It's a name. But
League replacement, totally fine, right?
Yeah, it's a replacement-level name.
That's right.
She decides she doesn't want to do dessert, or the group decides they don't want to do dessert. So three courses, the challenge is three courses. And Jen comes up with the idea, and I forgot to look at the analytics of this, whether it's true or not, but presumably through season six, a lot of people were sent home for their desserts on Restaurant Wars. I'm going to take Jen for her word on that one. But what did you think about that, Hershey?
So again, to give a basketball analogy, what's interesting is every single team that has lost the NBA finals has had a head coach. So if you're going to say that the solution to not lose the NBA finals is to not have a head coach, that's madness. So that's a question between, signal and noise, causation and correlation. I think that you're running a restaurant. And I think that you have a set menu. And I think that there wouldn't be a single person on earth who wore, even folks who don't like dessert, right? Like I know Kevin doesn't particularly like a sweeter dessert. If you walked into a restaurant that was a set menu and they were like, yeah, we're going to finish steak, it's going to be the last course, everyone already feels uncomfortable. That's not, that doesn't feel right. So I think that that's a huge mistake. I think if folks are getting in trouble and getting called out for terrible desserts, the solution is not to have no dessert. The solution is, okay, strip back the dessert, make it simple and make it executable, and then say, look, at least we did a dessert. It didn't win us any friends, but at least we finished with the dessert. So I think, to me, starting off with not doing dessert, if I was a judge, it would already make it really, really hard for me to allow you to win. Like the other team would actually have to mess up for you to win. The other thing I don't like about it is this is a cooking show. And yes, we've spoken about this before, that not all head chefs are excellent with desserts, but you have to have some skills. And I think that those four chefs are announcing to the judges, we do not believe in our ability to execute dessert. And I think that that might bite them in the butt come, you know, throughout the season.
Yeah. I mean, the counter argument and you know, is that, I mean, personally, if I'm going for three courses, I love the idea of having app seafood beef. Like I, like the truth of the matter is as a menu for forget execution, I'd much prefer to be at that, at the non-dessert meal. Like I,
interesting.
You don't need to give me a friggin' pear tart. Like give me, and again, I don't eat meat right now, but like, give me the, you know, the appetizer, the fish, the beef. You know, and that's just
for
me.
Beefy dinner. I'm like, you know what? I need a little sugar to finish off the night. Like I'm kind of craving that a little bit after a beef.
Then give me a fourth course. You know what I'm saying? Like then the, I mean, this is what the judge, and if, you know, at the judge's table, I would say, you gave us three courses. You give us a fourth course, you got to want dessert. I'm not going to dedicate a third of the meal to what can be accomplished by an Andy's candy.
Well, let me ask it this way, because it's still a restaurant experience, right? So for you, that would have been fine. And, you know, I know that you're like, but, you know, in that wonderful picture behind Tom, we can see, you know, there's you with Eric and Tom and Tom's wife. So when you went, there was four of you, right? So even if you would be okay, the other three might be there going, this is a bit weird and this is uncomfortable. And now suddenly your night's not pleasurable because the other three people legitimately are saying, this is a bit the way this is ended without dessert. It would affect
screw
the
them
quality.
we'll go to Straw and Straw on the way out, like down the street. Yeah. Look, at the end of the day, every single restaurant called Mission has an artisanal ice cream place within three blocks. So yeah, I know I'm gonna die on this hill. I get it. I'm doing a little shtick here, but my point is I don't have any real objections, and the truth is I think if I'm going out to eat, I'm going out to eat. You know, okay. If I want to go ice cream, you put the kids in the station wagon, you go to the freaking Dairy Queen.
Okay, so if that decision doesn't get them off on the wrong foot, maybe this one will. Laureen as the front of house.
Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher turned podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep, free shipping, vacuum-sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high-quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order. Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodle's just like, ah, whatever.
Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with the plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Look, that was, this is the thing that can't be said, right? You're the weakest chef among us. Get out there. And that's the thing they don't want to say. You know, it's one thing if you have a person who's enthusiastic about it. Remember, you know, what's his name? You know, from the hammy guy.
Joe Flynn.
No. From last season. Oh, San Diego Gazillionaire. Yeah, Malarkey. I'm sorry. I'm senile. You know, that guy lives for that. Eli had a real yen for it.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, what could not be said is, hey, you're a nice person. You're clearly the least skilled chef. Get out there. And that's what they wanted to say and couldn't say. Because they're also all three. Well, not Isabella, but they're all three.
I thought Isabella was perfect for front of
house. No. My point is they're all three really nice people, except Isabella isn't all that nice, but you know.
Yeah, I thought he, but as in terms of like being a class clown or someone who can like wow the judges table and keep them busy, like I felt like Isabella would have been the logical pick for front of house. And Laureen, even though she was running a catering company.
Do you want to meet that guy at the maitre d', Stan?
No, but not Laureen either.
It's like, do I want to meet like a sports talk radio on WFAN host? Like that's basically the temperament and comportment of this guy, right? Like, no disrespect to Isabella. I don't want to meet that guy at the front of the house.
Okay, all right. Put aside my comment about Isabella. Laureen,
no, like he's working the counter at Zabar's, for God's sakes.
Laureen was putting people to sleep.
Wow.
Laureen had so little energy and like, and she also didn't have the temperament to like keep the judges happy and distracted when things weren't going well. I thought it was a horrific pick for front of
they didn't know that though, probably.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. They've been living with her for weeks.
I only watched the two episodes leading up, so I'd be more indicative of her, but my read on it was, and we have all had nights like this, but that the mistake was made by the kitchen, right? Them deciding to eat courses on their own thing for professional chefs to allow it to happen. I've seen that deer in the headlights look before, and that's, oh shit, the ship is going down. I don't know what to do. I'm scared. I'm going to go and hide. So Russia, like there's two kinds of people, right? There's people that run towards chaos and people that run fight or flight, right? And so in retrospect, if you knew the ship was going to go down, you needed to pick someone who was more likely to be okay, to take the fight instead of the flight option. But I do think in retrospect, if they were thinking everything was going to be fine, I do think she was a good choice. I just don't, yeah.
Hershey, how much of a detriment was Jen Carroll steaming the clams and mussels to order?
I don't even understand it. None of it makes any sense to me. None of it makes the sense. I mean, they didn't even talk about it, but they kept showing it. She's portioning fish to order. What is happening? I've never seen that in my life. Like, you know how she had like there and she was put these like dirty offcuts stuck on her board and she kept like portioning. I've never seen that in my life. So like, I don't know what that was about. In my mind, I think that was about because they said, oh, you know, it looked like she was portioning fish and then folks started coming into the restaurant and she ran out of time. I don't know. Again, to me, the portioning of the fish would be one of the very first things that you do, because you want to get it into the fridge so that it's cooled down and it retains, you know, texture. But yeah, that was, all of it was very, very strange to me. And I think it might have been a decision based upon her running out of time, her not getting on mise en place ready in time.
Okay, so she doesn't decide to, you know, portion it out beforehand, doesn't do the mise en place, but was her fault that she was too confident in her abilities? Because she said earlier in the interview, I think with Kalikia, that she said, "I feel like I'm Superwoman, so I'm gonna do a lot here."
Right, but I think she was being self-deprecating. I think that was her way, Tom, of saying, "I'm an idiot who thought I could do everything, and I'm Superwoman." I took that as sort of a sarcastic, self-deprecating comment, which is it was too late to re-strategize.
True.
She, you know, it's me saying, "Oh God, you know, why did I do that? Because I'm a genius." Like I thought that was my interpretation, at least.
Yeah, I mean, even I want to pull up on that, because I mean, it depends on what time of the day it was, but I would imagine that a couple of hours. I still think you always have time until you. They look like they were doing a line up there last second, right? That they were going through the food with the servers literally last second while people were there, which means the menus would have been printed last second. So I think that you it's never too late. In restaurants, doesn't matter, Michelin star or down to bottom, we take dishes off the menu 5 minutes before lineup. You know what I mean? Like, it's no, for us, if it's not ready, it's not ready. And I don't mean take it off. I mean, there's stuff they could have done when they've said, okay, this is too much. I haven't done enough. My prep wasn't ready. I'm going to put my hand up now and say, look, this dish is not going to be as spectacular, but we're going to get stuff out not 40 minutes between courses.
Jen is so good, like, that it was so surprising to see her struggle here, right, Kevin?
Yeah, it really was. And I think, but again, it was, at least it seemed to me, and her, she said it, just, I mean, that decision was just, it just took too much time. I want to move on to the lamb, Tom.
Yeah.
And you know, at the judges' table, I really got the sense that Kevin felt terrible. Like, he knew he did Laureen wrong. And I don't know what happened with the prep. He's so good with protein and meat.
Yep.
Like, he's so good. I mean, Hershey, what do you sense happened with that rare lamb?
It seemed pretty obvious what happened. So I don't know why it was good of him not to mention it, but like, every oven is different, right? So he would have been cooking that, searing it off in the pan, and then finish it off in an oven, whether that be a combi or the under oven. And I just don't think he cooked a bunch of them before service to get a feel for that oven. I mean, there's no other way to do it, right? We've all moved into new houses or bought new appliances. You've got to cook a few times. It's no different in a restaurant. So I think, again, it was time. I don't think he spent enough time. Having said that, it looked like they served, you know, 15, 20 tables there. I would imagine after four or five, he would have got better at it. So I don't really know what happened after that. That food should not have gone out. Like, there's no... It's not a health and safety issue. Like, that's okay with lamb. You're allowed to serve it at that level. But I will say that you cannot put raw meat out like that. So chewing gum.
Oh, what a surprise.
Yeah, isn't that wow.
We got Jen on the line here. This was a surprise. I surprised Kevin and Hershey. Jen, how are you?
I had a error message of a problem with the audio, and I had to restart. So...
All good. We were just talking about it wasn't your best performance, but it was a Restaurant Wars that, let's just say we wanted to know more about your decision to cook to order.
Chef, did you run out of time on your mise en? Is that what happened? On your mise en place?
Yeah. So what you all don't know, what you didn't see, was the behind the scenes of our kitchen. You know, when I picked the kitchen upstairs, I thought it was the better kitchen, but little did we know that all of the equipment was pretty much faulty and not working properly. So while my prep and cook, I had two guys like underneath on the floor in the kitchen trying to fix the ovens and the mise en place. So Chef, I'm sure you have had that before when you're in the middle of service and trying to work over top of people. It's not the most ideal. So that led into a lot of different issues. But
can I ask, when did that happen? That from the get-go, you couldn't get at the equipment properly?
No, it was working. It was working. One of them wouldn't go on, and then like the gas wasn't hooked up properly, and then it was going on and off, and then it was fixed, and then it would go off, and so it was basically throughout the entire thing. So we thought we were good, and then it would shut down again.
Oh, crazy. Yeah. Did you have any thoughts about changing menus at all?
At that point, no. You're just in it, and you don't really. To make a decision to move, I think we probably would have ended up in the same place we ended up.
By the way, Jen, I wanted to say, and it's become a theme, the extent to which you have no desire to engage Tom in the kitchen during prep is hilarious. Like, it's one of my favorite running gags in the show.
Yeah, I see him coming. I'm like, nope. I have nothing to say to you. Just, I am busy.
You're like Ron Livingston in Office Space, like avoiding Gary Cole.
Any sort of discussions with management.
Like Lumberger is coming by your cubicle and asking you to work weekends. And
don't want
to
talk. Please move along. Hey, Chef, thanks so much for joining us here. And in such short notice, this Restaurant Wars was different because you didn't have to do any of the decor. You didn't have to do too much of the kind of atmosphere. Was that a detriment, do you think? Do you think you would have liked to have been able to do that? Or do you think it's just, let me focus on the food?
I was fine without doing any of it. And it was just more about the food than about the entire atmosphere. Because that is a whole nother project in itself. And they don't really give you any much more time, what I've seen with future Restaurant Wars, to do design, build, concept, everything. So this was definitely an easier Restaurant Wars than what they have morphed it into, for sure.
Unfortunately, I know this feeling, but you can maybe describe this feeling for those listening. That feeling of where the ship has sunk, past tense, and you look up and there's still tickets on the board.
Yeah, I think definitely all of us had that feeling, and we were just like, it kept like mounting up and mounting up, and we were just like, oh my God, how do we escape? And you just kind of want it to be over because everything just starts to go wrong, and there was nothing that was saving us.
Yeah, I know for me, it's the feeling of somehow things moving really fast and at slow motion at the exact same time.
Yeah, now add on a couple million people watching.
That's right. Exactly.
We had a few questions here. Did you know it was black cod, but you mistakenly called it trout, or did you honestly think it was trout and then you called it black cod?
No, I definitely knew that I made the mistake, and I was like, "Fuck! Why did I just say that?" So, yeah. I mean, you say things under pressure, and you're like, "Oh shit!"
Was that fun to do with blindfold?
Was it fun to do? I'm like,
the quick fire blindfold where you had to do a tag team, or was that just like way too stressful?
It was definitely stressful, but it was fun to do. But I mean, we just were, thank God we were all on the same page, and we were just tasting things and trying to bring it all together. But I mean, everybody has completely different styles. So we got a good dish.
I was going to ask, because I guess we'll talk about this a little bit. It felt to me like the thing that went wrong, other than this equipment thing that I guess we're learning about now. And I actually think there was a cutaway of two guys underneath an oven at one point, now that I think about it. But that decision that ultimately ended up with everyone working on one course at a time, like each chef knocking at it, what happened there?
Yeah, so I think we all just wanted ownership of our own dishes. And instead of having a collaboration like you should in a kitchen, I think we just all kind of went in, instead of being a full team, just went with each person doing their own thing instead of helping each other out. Because the tickets, you know, the tickets are coming in like one by one. So you do have, you know, first course on something, second course on different tables. So it's not like, hey, it's not banquet style where you're putting up 10 dishes, 10 dishes, 10 dishes, 10 dishes, you know. So in a sense, we all had to be working by ourselves to a point.
Right. But then obviously once you got weeded, as we like to say, on a course, once someone got weeded on a course, that's it. Like that course, there was no way out.
Yeah.
At the end, at the judges table, you were, once again, in the stew room, you were pretty emotional when Laureen got sent home. And then afterwards, Kevin said he didn't even want to talk because he was so angry. Can you kind of put us behind the scenes a little bit on what the emotions were like for you up on judges table and seeing Laureen go home, and what was Kevin so angry about, Tina?
For us, it was emotional because we all found failures in what we did ourselves. We all thought we failed in some sort of way. So it's always hard to see like a teammate go home. And it's usually like, okay, the front of the house is the scapegoat in sort of a sense. Like that's kind of how it goes with restaurant wars. So I know Kevin felt really bad because he was the one executing Lorene's dish a little bit more than anybody else. And there were mistakes across the board. There were mistakes from me. There were mistakes from Kevin. There were mistakes from Laureen, and it led to the entire thing falling down. So I know Kevin was really upset because he thought that he should have gone home because he thought he had more mistakes than anybody. And he thought it was his fault for everything. And he felt like Laureen was the scapegoat. So that's why he was really angry. And he actually almost took himself out of the competition.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was, I mean, it's a mind game. It's a really hard, it's besides cooking, it's just very emotional and stressful. And, you know, you learn to love everybody that you're there with and you're like working together, and to see somebody go home on like something that was not fully their fault is really hard.
By the way, I'm generally not a conspiracy theorist. Like in real life, I'm sorry. This is a real restaurant in a real hotel.
I know what Kevin's
I don't believe all these technical. It's always something. This is a cooking show. You're telling me they don't vet the freaking equipment? Like, I know, Jen, you don't have to answer this question because I mean you're a friend of the show. But I'm sorry. I'm just for the record. It's all fishy. The electricity coming out. I'm not talking about the home stuff where there aren't enough outlets and there's shorts. I'm talking about they walk into these Vegas restaurants that are palaces that have like gymnast grabbing wine bottles. They can do that, but they can't freaking have an oven that works. I'm sorry. Don't buy.
I don't know. I've been in a lot of really nice kitchens with really shitty equipment.
Okay.
A lot of equipment that just gets banged up and is not taken care of and not maintained. So
I was about to say the same thing. I was about to say, Chef, how long have you worked in kitchens? Chef Wendler Bernadon, like stuff goes down at Saturday night at 7:45. That's when it happens.
Yep.
And it don't matter if you've got one or three Michelin star shit goes down.
I am proven wrong.
I'm going to tell you, the best fed person in any restaurant on planet Earth is the dude that is willing to come in on a Saturday night at 8:45 every consultant. I have phone numbers of 6 or 7 cities in this country alone where I can call, and this dude will come in and he'll put this stuff together, and that dude gets fed better than anyone on planet Earth.
This is like Harvey Keitel in Pulp Fiction of restaurants.
Yeah.
Winston Wolfe.
Stuff goes down. You should try operating in the wonderful city that is New Orleans, where every like the power will just go off inexplicably. Like, you know.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Hey, Jen, I know you got to run, but I want to ask the decision to not do a dessert. Oh. Do you regret that decision? Ooh,
good question.
Yes. Yeah, it's not a complete meal. We were stupid. We were not fully thinking. We just all wanted to do what we wanted to do and weren't collaborating as a team, as a restaurant should have. So, yeah.
We were young. We were flighty. We were naive.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any other last thoughts about Restaurant Wars this year? You've been a part of how many Restaurant Wars? Is this?
Just the one because
just this one.
Yeah. So, I mean.
Did you think you were going home?
I had no idea. I honestly had no idea. I thought there was a very good chance of me going home. So I think we all did. So I'm glad I didn't.
I'm glad you survived because we gotta bring you back on the show for more than 10-15 minutes to recap stuff. So thank you so much for coming.
Can I jump in just one question? Oh. What are you up to in the lockdown? Well, tell us, like, what's going on?
So I've been doing a lot of virtual stuff. I've been doing a lot of online like classes and cookings and like corporate demos, hangouts, a lot of Zoom stuff. I am just starting to do dinners in like people's houses again. So really small, intimate dinners in people's houses with my culinary experience company. I'm on Patreon, so if anyone wants to follow me there, you can go on Patreon and follow and subscribe there. I'm just getting ready to open up Spice Finch for Indoor Dining, which is my restaurant in Philadelphia, but we've been doing takeout and delivery there. And we're just getting geared up to go inside. So
good.
Hustling, trying to make it through.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Jen.
Thank you. I'll see you all later.
I like it. The actual first person analysis. And I like being proven wrong. Like who knew? I just like the incidents in this show are just always just peak drama. And you have to appreciate my feeling, but I now am standing corrected.
Yeah, I think if they had played it up more on the show, I would believe you, Kevin. Like if it was a conspiracy and they were like, you know, pulling strings behind to like pull out the power into the oven, they would have played that a lot more. But because it was an honest mistake, they edited it out. They scrubbed it from the show to try to, because I think that's an admission that like we screwed up here. We don't want to put that on Jen.
By the way, from a competitive fairness standpoint, it's really rough. Like, and you could argue, okay, it was distributed at random. It could have been either team. You deal with it. It's sort of like having an injured player. You just have to kind of circle the wagons. But I have to say, from a competitive fairness standpoint, it's really hard to say this team wasn't at a massive disadvantage unless similar things were afflicting the red team.
Possibly. I mean, I don't think they recovered from very well. I mean, I think per the point, right, I think they sent home the person who could have done the most to recover from it. I think, you know, they were saying Lorraine got stuck, you know, deer in the headlights. And I think the best stuff that she could have done would be more to use, what was the term they used about Eli? Intense. She could have been a little bit more intense in her sort of delivery and approach on the floor. But yeah, I mean, possibly. It happens, Kevin. Kevin, it happens. I've had the light. We were cooking with gas in a full restaurant on a Saturday night at 7:45 and the power go out. And we closed out the rest of the night on candlelights with phone torches, making sure that stuff was cooked properly on the grill. So,
was this in Pasadena?
This was actually in Windsor in Melbourne in Australia, up on Dante. The lucky thing was we had a restaurant that had no menu, so it didn't matter. We could just like, this is what you're getting. They didn't know any better. But still, you know, it still was intense. Yeah.
Tom, you wanted to talk about Eli's sartorial choice?
Yes. So Eli comes in. We haven't even talked about the other team yet. So Eli is chosen to be the front of the house. And he seems like he's the drummer for like Linkin Park or something like that. Like he just comes off a very 2009 guy with his untucked shirt. Hey,
do you remember that, Tom? The untucked shirt with the blazer. And by the way, looks terrible on short men.
Yeah.
And yet he kind of embraced it. I just, that trend, you knew that was going to be one we'd look back on fairly soon with disdain.
Yes. And it was so delightful just to see him do it. Like, hey, do you think this works? And in 2020, if someone does that, you're like, no, go back into the dressing room and put some other shit on. But in this, it was a genuine, like, hey, do you think I look okay? And he's like, yeah, you look fine. Untucked looks good. And he nails it. The front of house, he does a really good job. And he's the youngest one there. He works in a restaurant, but I don't think he does a lot of front of house, but he did a really good job.
Yeah, I thought it was excellent. I will say, I mean, here's a word, because I know y'all like a little, this is a word that Kevin and I would have heard a lot growing up, which is schloch, which is a Yiddish term for just what Eli looked like, messy, schloch. And that is what he looked like. But yeah, I thought he nailed it. I thought he was intense. I thought he was, you know, that was a good word. He was engaged. He was involved. You know, people just want to know what's going on in life, right? Like if you're on hold with AT&T, if they check in minutes or 1 minute, you feel better. It's the same thing. People just want to feel involved. And I thought it was good. I liked the line of where I finally came and Padma said, I think it was, oh, it's taken a bit of a while. And he was like, yeah, it's almost like it's our first night. And I thought that was excellent. Just like have a bit of fun with it. So yeah, I thought he did an excellent job, all things considered, other than obviously the way he looked was not excellent.
Tom, Kevin, we saw a little dickishness from Michael Voltaggio, really for the first time on an acute level.
Really, I was siding with Robin here.
Yep.
You don't put your hands on my dish. That's more disrespectful than dropping an F-bomb to another chef. That's more unprofessional than that, right?
Yeah, and here's the other thing. Telling someone to relax in that situation, who himself isn't relaxed. It's one of the most ingenious rhetorical weapons in any stage of life, because by definition, the response to relax is going to confirm the charge, right? Okay. It's sort of like when people call women emotional. Like, the response is generally going to confirm the charge for obvious reasons. And telling someone to relax is that. Because the minute they respond, they're confirming your charge.
And I think the other thing about it is, I don't know, like, it's a kitchen. Like, people can use the F word. I thought he really – it was a control freak thing, right? He didn't trust her. As it turned out, we didn't eat it, right? The judges ate the pativier. They said they loved it. They thought it was the best thing she cooked. So he was well over his oars, right? And I just think that was a control freak thing. And actually, I was kind of impressed that she stood up to him and said, no, go away. Yeah, this is my shit. Go away. And I think if you look at it closely, I think his brother knew that he fucked up using the F word. And because his brother was kind of like, go to your – like, his brother was like sending him away. Go away. And, yeah, a leader is not a control freak. I don't think he did a very good job of leading there.
Yeah. By the way, he cooked some damn good food. That pressed chicken and the calamari noodles. They loved the cod with the zucchini tenderloin, which is kind of a fascinating concept, Hershey.
Yeah. I would have. I mean, I don't have you. Have, I don't know if I've ever eaten his food. Have you ever eaten his food?
No. His brothers. Or no, I have eaten his food. And
yeah, Michael.
Did you ever go to Inc, or was that after your time?
No, I didn't go to Inc, but it wasn't after my time, but it wasn't. The one in Pasadena, is that the one?
No. It was on Beverly and like Orlando.
Okay. No, I never made it there. I think they held it together because, honestly, I think their food came out in pretty decent time. I really felt like that's what it came down to. And, yeah, I mean, that's sad, you know, that I guess now that we have a little bit more perspective that they were challenged by their ovens, but, you know, their equipment. It would be to find a way to recover from that.
By the way, very 2009, sunchoke puree.
Don't talk to me about sunchoke puree.
Sunchoke puree, very 2009.
If you put scallops, very 2003, with like that crispy little bit of like bacon, you know what I'm talking about, like pancetta over the top. Or if you put in a little demi-tasse as your amuse-bouche, it's very 1999.
Did you catch the whole like Michael Voltaggio saying, you know why I have to do the four? What was it? What was the dish that I think Brian screwed up and Michael was mad? And he's like, you know why I have to do this again? Yeah, because they exploded. Yeah, that's right. And I'm going to have to do it again. No, I'm going to do it. Like Mike. What
was the duo of beef?
Yeah, the duo beef. They call it like Kameskis or something like that. I don't know. So Michael Voltaggio was biting people's heads off left and right in the back. And I guess we could have seen that coming just because, you know, Michael Voltaggio is Michael Voltaggio. He says, people mistake my confidence for arrogance. Now, in those situations, I feel like that's arrogance. Or you know, what he did to Robin, I think was purely about he didn't trust her. And when she swore or cussed at him, it gave him the out of like, that's why I'm mad. But that's not why he was mad. What he was mad about is that he had Robin on his team and he didn't want Robin on his team because he didn't trust Robin. So I sided with her, and all of this stuff in the back didn't seem to matter because out in the front, the judges love their meal.
I think they love their meal. And I think also, listen, we spoke before about that they were under the pump, as in they didn't get their mise en place, their prep ready. It sounds like, you know, to all of their credits, really, they all did dishes that required a lot of getting ready. Like, if you think about it, press chicken and press calamari, that's all in the mise en, that's all in the work during the day. And I think they loaded up their work during the day so that they were essentially just firing and cooking at night. And I think that helped them as opposed to, you know, what happened with the other team. You know, there could have been ways, for example, with that lamb. And again, we don't know if this was, this came down to the equipment, but you could have, there are other ways to cook the lamb so that you're not cooking it from raw to order. Right? Mm-hmm. There are ways of braising the lamb and put it on a fire. So that was also probably mistakes, I think.
Kevin, so Michael Voltaggio wins and he decides to divvy up the winning prize to the rest of his teammates. And Brian Voltaggio says, F that. I don't want my share. And Mike says, why? What's wrong? And he's just like, you know what? I think unprofessional behavior should not be rewarded. What'd you think about that?
I mean, look, I appreciate that he wants to take a stand against his brother's behavior. I don't quite understand the logic, because actually you're giving him back $2,500. So you are kind of rewarding him, unless the punishment is the knowledge that he was such a, that Brian thought he was such a dick that he's willing to kind of forego the money, which I guess is a punishment, kind of a psychic punishment. But, you know, I mean, all power to him. I mean, there's a certain nobility to that. Clearly, I mean, it's such an interesting relationship to observe, especially given sort of our recent conversation with Ash, that, you know, the two of them tend to isolate themselves among something I didn't realize. And now when you kind of go back and look, that they're kind of in their own world amongst the cast, it does start to really make sense.
Yeah. Hershey, what are your thoughts on Michael winning this episode? Obviously the dishes he cooked are very well, but do you think Brian has a point here that he didn't deserve to be the winner, quote unquote?
I don't know who, I mean, other than Eli, who, right? Because his brother didn't, his brother's food didn't go very well. Well, desserts are good, but you're never going to, you know, I mean, I'm a dessert freak, but you're never going to win it with desserts, I don't think. I think probably he was the most deserving, if I'm going to be honest. And I think, you know, again, it's the way it's edited. I mean, this is a big conversation that we're having in the industry now with a lot of the things that have been going on with the changes in our communities and our societies, that you don't have to be a dick to make stuff work. There's a double-edged sword to it. There's a reason why there are a lot of chefs that act like that, and that's because it does, on some level, get some results. Now, there are other ways to get results without doing it. I'm just saying they would have shown the elements of it that had this really big blow up, because that's good television. But there would have been elements of it as well, of him in there in that kitchen driving things along, that he probably did deserve credit for, if I'm going to be honest. So, no, I think he's the deserving winner of this. Him, Eli, I think, is a close second.
Is there anything in this episode that you'd like to mention before we go? Anything that, any notes that you want to get off your chest? Or maybe just, you know, big picture thoughts about restaurant industry at this point in time versus where we are now? I know it's obviously a circumstance. Crazy circumstance now.
But. Yeah, I think a lesson that, I mean, for me anyway, that a lot of us tried to learn in 2008, 2009 was around trying to keep things a little smaller and prices a little lower. And I think what's interesting about that is, you know, they would have opened that before that financial shutdown, had the casual one upstairs or whatever, it's the fine dining one upstairs, the casual one downstairs. I think what's interesting is we certainly had a 10-year period up until this shutdown of rewarding chefs like Mr. Voltaggio for their kind of more arrogance or confidence, whatever you want to call it, and their more abrasive kind of nature. And I think it's interesting to see where we go from here. Do we perhaps, instead of like what I just said, his abrasiveness would have helped drive that along, right? But there's also, you can also get these with honey. So there would have been other ways to win that. Are we going to see moving forward now that we perhaps reward chefs who don't have that abrasiveness? I don't know. It's an open-ended question. I'd like to see that, if I'm going to be honest.
Kevin, do you have a- I mean, it's such an interesting environment because, and by the way, this is, I'm not offering this as an excuse or whatever, but the intensity of a kitchen is like the closest thing, I think, to like, per last night's Boston-Toronto game and the intensity there. Like, it seems like a workplace that almost encourages emotional reactions, immediate reactions, which are generally what produces that behavior. You're reacting, right? Like when you have time to consider, okay, I need to be rational about this. There's no reason I need to bite someone's head off. That is a reaction. And it's hard for me to believe that it will ever be. Now, what you said is you can reward and punish, but the idea that we'll ever eradicate aggressive communication. Now, by the way, that doesn't include sexist, homophobic, thoroughly abusive, but the relaxed, the sort of, I mean, frankly, the attitude that Michael copped that evening. I'm incredulous that we'll ever eradicate it. No different than we'll eradicate it on a NBA court. Ain't no different than, frankly, a lot, you know, in political campaigns I've worked on where it's just the intensity produces yelling, you know, screamers to some extent.
So I'm okay with sort of, I'm not so much talking about the ways of communication. I agree. Sometimes you have to deliver things very quickly and efficiently. That is important. I think a lot of what we who all of us is on modeling behavior. And so I think there would have been a 16-year-old person who would have watched the show 10 years ago, who's now 26, and saying, okay, well, this person won, right? So like, this behavior is what this is how I have to act if I'm going to be a winner. So I kind of think some of that, right? Like the NBA, you guys know this a million times better than me. Head office doesn't seem to be very good at it, but NBA head office seems to be very, very upset with certain individuals, Draymond Green, who yell at the referees for everything and anything. Uh-huh. And the reason why they don't like it is because there are 6-year-old kids watching who are thinking, this is what I have to do. I have to yell at a referee, right? So, like, my issue is more so the modeling on the behavior, more so the rewarding. I think that brusque, quick, instant communication will never go away. I do think, you know, the dickish behavior, if you want to use that term, we don't need to model that behavior for young people. That's what I think. So, and listen, I'm no touchy-feely kind of guy. Like, you've seen me here. I've been here on this podcast with my espresso cup that's full of rye whiskey. So, like, I'm no kind of, like, angel over here, I want to be clear. But, like, you know, I think that there is not a fine line between, you know, pushing towards hard, towards a goal, and really being, frankly, disrespectful to people.
To wrap up, we always do a Where Are They Now? And Chef Loreen Wicket, Hope, she is, I guess, the head of Left Coast Catering in San Francisco. And in an exit interview with TV Guide about this episode, she said, I was misunderstanding this. I thought this was Top Chef, not Top Floor Manager. So she was a little bit bummed out that she got sent home for being front of house. Maybe, I don't know if anyone else should have been voted off. She didn't say that, but she has a very successful catering business in San Francisco. And she said she actually didn't want to be on Top Chef, but her colleagues or her coworkers at the catering business said that she should. And the producers said that the less interested that she was in her interviews, the more interested they became of her. So the fact that she went into the audition was like, I don't want to be here.
Like playing hard to get?
I don't know. So she was like, I mean, I guess I'm auditioning for the Top Chef contestant. And they were like, you don't sound interested at all in this. So you know what? You're going to go on the show. And so when she got voted off, you could kind of feel that, you know, it wasn't the end of the world. But Loreen, Left Coast Catering in San Francisco. Another thing to note is that RM Seafood is closed. As of 2 years ago, that restaurant in Las Vegas, Rick Wooten's restaurant, has closed in Vegas, and I'm sure he's got an empire somewhere else. Rick Moonen, I recognized him coming onto the show when he showed up. I didn't quite know what he was known for, which is that he like kind of started the sustainable seafood movement in America. Any other thoughts about Loreen or Rick Moonen here before we go?
No, nothing really specific. I went to her site and it looks like a lovely catering company. And I imagine they're having probably a tough time as well in any business of that capacity. I mean, Hershey, you want to tell us about your project?
Yeah, I'll give you a little overview. So came here in January to get open, sort of a proof of concept. So really, really simple kind of idea based on the Italian stand-up espresso bars, but with a touch of Texas, which I come in from. So espresso, cold coffees, all sort of stand up and then grab and go tacos. So pre-wrapped, ready to go, breakfast tacos. Really based on the notion of that, I just think people in this country don't eat breakfast enough, and I think it's because they have very limited options. I know in Australia we eat breakfast quite often, and there's no reason why, you know, if you come in and grab a coffee and a couple of breakfast tacos, we can get you out under $10. There's no way you could really get a coffee and a breakfast at home for less than that, so we can make this cheaper. It's fresher, it's healthier. And then we pay tribute to some things where I come from, Melbourne, which is a very multicultural city. So our tacos are dressed and flavored with soy and vinegar, which are the dumpling sauces that you'd get on a Sunday morning or anytime you go to dumplings, because I just think soy and vinegar with egg is the flavor you want any morning of the week. And then we came here as an idea. It's called Small Victories. We want to try and see if we can, these are really easy to open. They open in really small locations and they're serviced by central kitchens. So you get a few open. And the idea is really to see if we can, specifically working with minority and low income communities, take young folk, Put them in as, you know, these venues really need two operators. So put them in as the second person, give them a chance to train and learn, and basically give them the next venue that opens. So give them a substantial ownership with 30-40%. It speaks really great for us because we don't have to worry about staff turning up because this person gets ownership. And it really gives us an opportunity to speak into certain communities who think, look, my chance is really to only, you know, to be some, let's say, you know, big billionaire. That's all I think about when I see a business. You want to say, no, you can actually own your own small business. It's not going to give you $100 million a year, but it's going to pay you well. You can get a mortgage and send the kids to school and really give an opportunity to folks who don't have the wealthy cousin or the tax or the uncle that has money to invest in a business.
This is a great initiative in a great city.
It's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tom, closing thoughts. We're down to seven.
I think the seven best chefs there, outside of Robin, I think the seven best chefs are there.
Yeah. Excited to see. For Tom Haberstroh, for Hersey Ash, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.